Angie's List is now Angie, your home for everything home. Angie still has the same top pros and reviews you've counted on for more than 20 years, only now you'll also get access to all the tools you need to make your home a happy place. Inside, outside, big or small, Angie helps you find the right solution for whatever you need done, all from your phone. It's simple to find upfront pricing and instantly book hundreds of projects. You can even search pricing guides to see what others paid for similar jobs and easily compare quotes from top local pros to make sure you're getting a fair price. From lawn care to repairing the AC to the project of your dreams, Angie has your home projects handled from start to finish. Plus, when you book and pay through Angie, they'll cover your project up to the full purchase price plus limited damage protection with their happiness guarantee. Make your home an Angie home. Check out Angie.com today. And for more on the happiness guarantee, go to Angie.com/happiness-guarantee.htm.
Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, comedian Felicia Madison talks about how she found her career later in life.
I decided to take a class with my friend Nancy Tepper, who is partner now in Empty Nesters. We took a comedy class together, and I am super hypercritical of myself. Like, I always like talking down, very like just never positive at all. Most of my friends that know me know that about me. So I took this class. I did my graduation class, and they send you the tape of your set. And it took me about like a week or two to look at it. And I watched it finally, and I was like, you know what? Not bad. Which for me is like an Academy Award.
Today on the show, comedian Felicia Madison talks about finding her passion later in life. Stay close.
Hey, it's Felicia Madison. You're listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, if you're a new listener, you have a lot of catching up. I'll say that. But either way, welcome to Storyworthy. Now, I hope you guys enjoyed the show last week with comedian Gary Robinson. Gary talked about meeting his heroes. And here's how he does it, Felicia. He and his friends, they would crash movie premieres.
Wow.
Yeah. And they were very clever about it. And they got into all sorts of movie premieres and then the after party as well. And they got to meet, you know, all his favorite stars, you know, like Clint Eastwood. And, you know, it's such a great story. So go back, you guys, listen to Gary Robinson last week talking about meeting his heroes, but not today. Today I'm here with another fabulous comedian, and this girl's from New York, and I've been wanting to connect with you, Felicia, for a long time. Like, I keep seeing your name, and I'm sure we're friends on the socials and stuff, but somehow it hasn't happened. I don't know why. Do you know why?
Probably because you live in LA and I live in New York.
Yeah, I guess. But I mean, now, especially, you know, I don't do anything, you know, any interviews in person anymore.
We're both living in our closets now. So now we got to meet.
That's right. There's a whole new thing about being in the closet these days. And most people are, you know, obviously they're recording. They've come up with a lot of great recording ideas. Have you noticed that, Felicia?
Oh my God. It's just like literally I have like a bevy of equipment here. My whole closet is now like a recording studio. It's amazing. And like every day I see someone. I used to do Zoom shows all through the pandemic, and I had a comedy friend. Every day he had a new gadget on his desk, and every day he had the new gadget. The next week I had to get the new gadget. So, and we still can't get anything to work. So go figure.
That's hilarious. Yeah, that's so funny. And, you know, closets are good recording spaces, obviously, because it's small. The clothes kind of buffer you. And I've got like foam pads on the wall and a pad under my feet. And yeah, it actually works pretty damn good.
So what are we going to do with this room when we come out of the closet? It's going to be like a sex room. It's all foam and padded. Just need some chains and we'll paint it red.
That's right. Maybe a torture room. You don't know. You don't know.
It's a green room. Now it's a red room.
That's right. Felicia, you have performed in so many of the clubs in New York, and I really admire that because, well, you know, you really know that scene. So it's not just you've been to Gotham or you've been to The Stand, but you've also been, you know, to Caroline's, and then you've been to the Comedy Cellar, and then you've been, you know, you've just performed everywhere. So how is it now in New York as we're coming back into, you know, real life?
It's exciting. Everyone is super excited to be performing again in New York. I mean, we're starting to get a little bit nervous now that there are all these variants coming in. But the general consensus is everyone gets up on stage. I'm starting to tell comedians, don't talk about Zoom because it's becoming like the hack topic to talk about when you get on stage. Like, I've had like four comedians in a row get up and talk about, I'm so glad to not be on Zoom. But everyone's super excited and the audiences are super excited. So
yeah.
I was a little nervous because when we started back doing stand up first, we did outdoor shows, on the street. We actually recreated our club on the street of Manhattan, which was super cool.
Oh my God.
It was super cool. It was super successful and people loved it. And
now wait, was this your lunchtime thing or was this a night show?
This was a night show that I did in conjunction with New York City's Open Culture Program, where they shut off the street. So I arranged to get the street in front of our club shut down. And they literally, I brought up the chairs and the tables. We blocked off the street. I got a stage. I got lighting. I got everything. It's like I literally recreated the club on the streets of Manhattan. It was the coolest thing ever. And unfortunately, the local garage next to us, who I got approvals from, shut us down. They filed a lawsuit with the government. So I had to shut it down. Yeah.
Wait, what was their problem? Was it noise or trash or what?
Well, they have an entrance and an exit on the street that we closed off, but they also have an entrance and an exit on another street. And I called them and I said to them, because I was required to approve it with them, and I said, we're going to be shutting off your street a couple of days a week, but you'll have egress from there. And I know you have another entrance. Is that okay? And they said, yes, as long as our monthly parkers can leave, we're fine. And I hung up the phone and I sent a nice little email confirming, and I sent it off to him. And a week after, you know, I guess they started getting complaints and they sent a legal letter to the government, and a huge fight ensued. I was so mad. And I was like,
the city, you mean he wrote a letter to the city,
to the Open Culture. And I said, this whole point of this program is to help the poor, struggling, starving artist that has no connections. And big, bad, big government comes in and sends a big, bad lawyer. And they didn't know who they were dealing with, because I said, I can send a big bad lawyer too if you want. And I fought with them for a little bit. I got them to let me finish my shows for the end of May, and then we moved it indoors.
Boy, that sounds like a lot of fun. That really sounds like fun, though. I mean, so many comedians, you know, got really, comedians have a lot of ingenuity, I think, anyways, but that is very clever. I mean, to make that happen.
That was
really great.
It was super cool. And it was one of their most successful programs, which was a bummer. And it was a lot of work, and I relied on, a lot of volunteers to do it. So it wasn't terribly, you know, profitable venture, but it was a good venture. People were just happy. Like when we were setting up, people would be walking by and like stopping and being like, oh my God, what's going on? This is so exciting. I'm going to come back. We sold tickets, and then we had lines of people just gathering around as the show was going on. And at the last minute, I decided to buy this donation box, and people were like, I never saw so much cash. It's been so long since I saw cash, you know, like no one carries cash. Who carries cash anymore, you know? So, and then I realized that halfway through, so I put my Venmo sticker on it. But
that was so smart.
Yeah, we made a lot of money. So I was able to pay the volunteer some money. So it was great.
That's really great. Yeah, that's really great. You are a producer in New York City in for comedy. And do you mainly work out of the West Side Comedy Club then?
I'm actually the talent booker and manager and director of new talent there. So I'm basically running the club now.
Wow.
Yeah. So
wow.
I'm chef, cook, and bottle washer.
That is so interesting. I actually didn't know that. Now, I was there in May and I had a set at Gotham, which was really fun, my first time. And it was full. I mean, there were a lot of people. They had it somewhat restricted, but there were still 200 people there, which was cool. And then I did that Broadway comedy club. But I wish I would have known that you were there. I might have seen you. Darn it. See, this is why we're connecting, Felicia. We have to connect.
Yeah, well, we were outdoors at that point, and that would have been fun to have you come by. Yeah. But now wow. we're open indoors partially, and in September, God willing, or COVID willing, we will be fully opened in the fall.
That's great. It's just great. I'm so happy for you. And believe me, I'll get back to New York, so I'll definitely hit you up for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, the biggest problem we're having is hiring staff, as I'm sure everyone is. You know, we don't have enough people to work.
And that's a number of reasons, right? Like, there's several reasons for that, right? I mean, not just COVID, but some people are still getting unemployment and they don't want to work.
It's unclear. Yeah, I mean, I think people, like someone said to me, you know, people would rather stay home because they're collecting unemployment. It's like no one's has a grand plan of, oh my God, I need to take this job because it's all I want to do is be like a waitress at a comedy club. You know, it's usually people that are like the actors and actresses and other people that are trying to make ends meet while they pursue their dreams. And a lot of them aren't here in New York.
But they're coming back, right? Aren't Broadway's coming back and they're rehearsing now. Do you see people kind of out and about, you know, around New York City? Are there rehearsals happening?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I haven't seen it. We're not close to it, but I do know that they're thinking about coming back in September and they are getting things together and people are coming back, but it's slow. I mean, I know, like, from my personal experience from just running my Zoom shows, it was just so funny to see so many comedians doing their comedy from their childhood bedrooms. And they'd be like, and they'd get to like a dirty joke and they'd start whispering because like my mom's in the next room.
Oh my God. Wait, let me ask you something. Being in New York City, do you know a lot of people or do you think a lot of people moved out of the city, right?
Of course. Yeah, that's part of the problem.
I know. But now, is there a lot of vacancies in New York? Do you see apartments for let, as it were, or no?
There's definitely, I think now's a good time to come back and get deals and do stuff. Yeah.
I wonder, because when people leave, they're leaving rent control, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, people were leaving their leases. They just were cutting their leases and leaving. Yeah.
Well, you know, early in the pandemic, New York really looked like the scariest on TV because, you know, it just looked like, oh my God, it's so unusual to see New York City come to a dead stop. You know, that just doesn't happen. And that was that was a real tragedy when we were seeing like those refrigerated trucks and stuff. Like, oh God, it's so crazy. We're living through this time, isn't it?
It's unbelievable. I'm just scared. I'm hearing rumblings. I'm just scared it's coming back.
Oh God.
Yeah, I'm just hoping to God it's not. But
now, you're vaccinated, of course. And the only people you let into the club, do they have to prove vaccination? Or,
you know, it's funny you mentioned that because that's just becoming an issue right now. It used to be that we had to have proof of vaccination and the government lifted all requirements. So as of now, we're asking everyone to be vaccinated, but we're not asking for proof. But I'm going to change that because now I think people are complaining and people want that. And it seems like that's the way to go.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I mean, I feel for you as somebody running a club because there's so many choices that have to be made. And of course, we're all passing microphones and, you know, it's just... Yeah, it's a scary time. Well, listen, podcasting is pandemic proof. So thank you for being here. And you bring forth the topic today, finding my career later in life. And I don't know how people find careers early in life. Like, how do people make these choices? Like, when they're 18, 20, 22. Like, I have two nieces. One is a veterinarian and one is a pharmacist, and they're sisters. And they're both so bright. I mean, you know, obviously years and years and years and years and years and years of schooling. But like, they have been doing that since they started off in college. They both had those paths chosen. I can't imagine choosing my path when I was 19 or 18. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's a gift. I think it's a gift to, you know what you want from such a young age. And and part of my story is it's a lot of luck just finding something that you love and that you're passionate about.
Yeah.
I have one kid that kind of knows what he loves to do, and two that are still exploring it.
I guess it's just like, in other words, I was a flight attendant for 7 years in my 20s, but that wasn't a career because you couldn't get better at it. I mean, you couldn't do better. You're going to make the same money no matter what. And the pay scale is as, you know, it's seniority. So I would never call that a career. It was a job. It was a good job. I liked it, but it wasn't like I can make any headway with that job. You know what I mean? There wasn't like, you're not going to be a flight attendant and then you become a pilot. I mean, it doesn't go that way.
A flight attendant, you know? Then you become a wife. Isn't that the plan?
Yeah, that's right. Right. So, yeah. And so, you know, I stopped flying when I was 30, and then I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I went to the Peace Corps. You know, doesn't everybody? I mean, I'm just like, it just takes time. And I didn't get to LA until, you know, in my 30s. And when I really decided I want to be a comedian and I'm just going to go for it. But it's hard to choose that path, obviously, because the risk is so huge.
You chose your path at a very young age. It was an adventurer.
Yes, it's true. I've always been an adventurer, but I know, but like, what, like you just said, it's about passion.
Right.
It's about what makes you excited. Why do you want to get out of bed? And if it's just a job, then, I mean, yeah, okay, that's a job, but I don't feel like those are careers.
Right. Yeah. Well, I was just having this conversation with someone about being amateur at something, and he was saying that being an amateur, it comes from the Latin word of amor, which is love. So if doing what I love means I'm an amateur, then I'm an amateur.
I like it. Good. Yeah. I like that. I'll be an amateur too. I don't care.
I want to stay an amateur, but I am a professional because I do get paid.
That's right. You do get paid. And that's what matters.
Marriage is my amateur.
How old are your children, by the way?
Oh God, very old. 26, 23, and 19.
Wow, that's something else. My girl's 14, so she's got a little bit, not really childhood left, but like, she's a little bit under my thumb for a couple of more years.
A couple more years? Lucky you. Boy, are you optimistic.
Oh, wait.
I think you have a couple of more days.
Is that what you're saying? Yeah, I guess I never thought of that. I guess I never thought maybe she's going to like it, you know, like to just stick around here. I kind of like that, but
they're nice when they're young, but when they get to be, yeah, usually when they turn teenagers, they become nasty. I just had a new joke that just happened because my daughter just got her wisdom teeth out, and I went to the doctor and I had a ton of work to do. So I brought like all my legal pads and all my stuff. And the doctor looked at me and said, "Well, I'm going to be putting her out for an hour, but it looks like you have a lot of work to do. Do you want me to keep her out for longer?" And I replied, 3 years would work for me.
Oh my gosh. That is so funny.
So she outgrows her like nasty teen behavior.
No, my daughter, boy, she can be so mean. I can't even believe it. I'm shocked. And people around us will say like, "Bama, what did you just say? Like, don't say that to your mom." And I'm trying so hard because I know what's going on, you know, with her little head and her little frontal lobe is not fully grown and it's time to start separating, because they do say that if children stayed as damn cute as they are at 3 and 4, then it would be impossible to separate. So by them becoming little assholes, we're able to, and they're able to pull apart.
Yeah. Well, my mantra during my kids' teen years was, this is normal. This is normal. This is normal. It was like my mantra to calm me down whenever I was ready to explode at them.
Yeah, it's true.
What they're supposed to be doing. It's normal.
It's true. It's age appropriate. Good, good. That was good. Good talk, Felicia, right there. Good talk. All right, you guys, we're going to get over to Felicia's story in just a second. But before we do, I wanted to remind you guys, follow me on social media at Storyworthy, and then check out StorySmashShow.com to find out when Story Smash, the storytelling game show, is coming back, because that was at the Hollywood Improv every month for 3 years till the pandemic. And now we're trying to get back in, but they still only have the main room open, but they're opening up the side rooms shortly. So I expect Story Smash to be there by September. So again, check StorySmashShow.com for the latest information. And of course, if you follow me on social media, I will hound you daily once the shows are back. So, you know, you're going to win either way. That's what I'm saying. All right, you guys, she's here right now, Felicia Madison. You hear her talking. She is a comedian in New York City, and she's the founder of Laughing Affairs, which produces, now I got to hear about this. It's a daytime lunch show called Laugh-er-size. Come laugh your ass off. It's and it's basically daytime comedy, yes?
Yes, yes. It started in, when I first started comedy, I did it because all, at the time, a lot of my friends were moms with kids, and nighttime wasn't a great time for them to leave. It was, you know, homework time, bedtime, you know, and plus they were going down to the clubs with a lot of young people with comedy that wasn't really appropriate for them. So I decided to bring the comedy to them. So I found, you know, a lunchtime venue with a room. And when the kids were at school, they came, they had those ladies who lunch, and they laughed.
Yeah.
And I did a bunch of them. And then I brought them to West Side Comedy Club, which was my first venture into starting to work at West Side.
Yeah. You mean producing shows and yeah.
Yeah. I started producing the shows there, and then I started doing my open mics there. And then I became the new talent director, and then I became the booker. And now I'm basically now running the joint.
I think that is so exciting. The talent booker and the new talent director. New talent director, what does that mean? That means like the newest comics coming up or?
Yeah, I started, it was called F Comedy Club. And, you know, you're familiar with the whole comedy world. You start off in the comedy world and you start doing bringer shows. And then you do those for a while and then you kind of exhaust your bringer and you move on to producing shows.
You run through your list of family and friends.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is the life. You'll appreciate this. It's like when you're beginner comic, you're like, you bring people and then you get over it. You produce people and then you produce shows. And then you're like, how come comics don't bring people? You know, it's like,
yeah,
it's the circle of life. So anyway,
comedy.
The circle of life. Yeah. So after about 6 to 10 years of producing your own shows and bar shows and other shows, you eventually hopefully get past. So I wanted to provide a really good bringer option for that mid-level comedian where they could come to a club, do a great show. So I find comedians that I curate them, and I find really good comedians, and I work with them in the mics, and I do classes with them. And 4 or 5 of them have been passed and have gone on to do really great things.
That is so exciting. Yeah. And when they're passed at the West Side Comedy Club, then you let them come back and for regular sets.
Yeah, they
right?
come back. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, they come back for regular sets. They get paid. They host. I've helped a few get representation. And it's been really great. Yeah. A lot of them call me their momager.
Oh my God. That's hilarious. Momager. That's very funny. And, you're not doing it anymore, but I know you were doing a podcast called Empty Nesters, the initials M and then the initial T. Empty right. Nesters, and I, it took me, I don't know, 10 minutes to understand MT was empty.
Empty.
I don't know why that took me so long, but that's really funny. As a parent, it's kind of a parenting podcast.
Right. It's about being an empty nester, and the T, I'm the M, Madison, and the T is my college roommate, really great friend of mine, Nancy Tepper. She's the T, so it's Empty Nesters. And it's sort of a little bit about what we're going to be talking about with my journey. It's helping women who become empty nesters rediscover and find their passion and giving them the tools and speaking to people that have changed their lives and how you do it and how to find your passion. And the one thing that I learned, the most important thing about it all, if you want to change your life and learn something, there's something called Google and YouTube. Yeah.
I know.
Apparently, you can learn everything you need to know on that.
You can.
So we're still doing it. We pivoted a little bit during the pandemic, and we've been doing panel discussions.
Mm. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, our next one's going to be on travel, because now that everyone's starting to travel, people are concerned as to if it's safe and what should we look out for and all that. So.
Do you guys talk about kids at all or not really?
We try not to.
No, it's not really a parenting podcast. It's not a parenting podcast. It's a post-parenting podcast or something.
Yeah. We talk about it like a little bit. When we started, we were both venturing into being empty nesters. And we thought there were going to be like a lot of sad sob stories and we were going to be helping people. And what we found is like, no one's sad about it. Everyone's so super funny. Happy.
Well, that's the thing. If you do your job right as a parent, they should want to leave. They should want to walk out the door at 18 or 20 or something.
Well, it's kind of like what you said when they're teenagers and you're ready for them to leave. It's the same thing with the adults. It's like you're ready for them to leave the house. It's like
it's an agreed upon situation. Yes.
I've done my job and I need to live my life now. Thank you.
That's right. That's right. And you guys can find more about Felicia over at her website, FeliciaMadison.com, and also on Twitter at Felicia L. Madison. Is L the middle name?
L is actually my legal last name. So, Felicia Madison is my maiden name.
Oh,
I was born Felicia Joy Madison. And when I got married, the joy left my life.
That's so funny. So you took your husband's last name.
I took my husband's name. Yeah. But then when I went into comedy, I went back to Felicia Madison because it's a better
name.
It's
so clean. And, yeah. It's a great name.
And I also thought, like, yeah, my husband would probably appreciate when my humor starts getting out there, not being associated with me.
That's so funny. That's funny. Wendy Liebman, comedian Wendy Liebman, she has her husband. And, you know, one time we're done at the improv and I'm like, oh, I have to take, I got to take Wendy. We're going to, you know, whatever, the show, whatever. And I said, sorry to take her away. And she said something like, oh my God, I spend way too much time with him or something. Like it was very funny. Great girl. Great girl. All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Felicia.
Felicia Michaels. I get confused with her. I have a really funny story about her where someone was like actually, I think, trying to pick me up thinking I was Felicia Michaels.
Oh my God. That's so funny. That's exactly what I was thinking, because Felicia Michaels, Felicia Madison, there's not that many Felicias, and then you both have the M.
That bitch stole my name.
Too funny.
Now I'm rendering the story. I was actually auditioning for a part and I had to send in my audition. It was during COVID. He's like, I love you. Send it in. We want you. You're the first person we want. I'm like, okay, great, whatever. I send it in. And we're having all these conversations. It's like, yeah, but make sure it's not political because I know you have a lot of political stuff. And I was thinking to myself, I have like no political. That's when I realized
he got
the wrong Felicia. So,
yeah. Oh, boy. That is so funny. Was it uncomfortable for him?
No, I think he covered it and just said, oh, thank you. But we found someone else. But I did get to work with Felicia over the pandemic, which was fun.
Oh, nice. Yeah, she's great.
I didn't get to meet her. I booked her on a few things in the city and I was on her podcast. Oh. But we actually did get to meet person in person.
Yeah, she's a great girl. All right, you guys,
wherever
you are.
We should do the Felicia and Felicia show.
I think that would be really good. Two Felicias.
Right? The two Felicias.
All right, you guys, wherever you are, put your hands together for Felicia Madison.
Oh, thank you. Well, my story starts out in a little town in New Jersey where my parents moved because they wanted to raise their kids in the suburbs. They grew up in the city. They weren't educated. Neither one of them graduated college, and my father was a manual laborer. And they wanted their kids to grow up, go to a good college, and be whatever they wanted to be in life as long as they were doctors or lawyers. So I went to college and I majored in biology, and I minored in marketing. So the only thing I was qualified to do when I graduated was sell drugs. Profitable, but not what I wanted to do. I did not go to medical school because I failed physics. But I kind of wandered around in a bunch of different unfulfilling careers and eventually got married and had kids. And I have to say, being married and having kids is very unfulfilling. So I was happily married. I had three kids, always kind of looking for what it was I wanted to do when I grew up. And then finally, when my youngest was in high school and wanted absolutely nothing to do with me and was a typical teenager, I decided to take a class with my friend Nancy Tepper, who is the my partner now in MT Nesters. We took a comedy class together. And I am super hypercritical of myself. Like, I always like talking down, very like just never positive at all. Most of my friends that know me know that about me. So I took this class. I did my graduation class, and they send you the tape of your set. And it took me about like a week or two to look at it. And I watched it finally, and I was like, you know what? Not bad. Which for me is like an Academy Award. So it was really very amazing. It was a very amazing feeling. I just loved it. And if people have said this to me, and I tell this to people also that are thinking of doing comedy, you know, make sure you want to do it, because once you do it, you're never going to stop. It's like a drug. It's a drug. So I proceeded to do a lot of different things. I produced, I sort of made my own opportunities. And then I wanted to write a pilot about my life. Upper East Side mom by day, stand-up comic by night. And that was before The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. Thank you very much. And when I was just finishing my pilot, getting ready to send it off to people, I saw the promotion for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. And I will say it was a good thing I was on the ground floor when I did, because when I jumped out the window, I did not die. But someone suggested to me that I do a one-woman show on the story. So I submitted to The Fringe and was accepted. And then I was like, oh, shit, now I need a one-woman show, which I hadn't written at the time. So I went around to a bunch of different people and I was explaining them my story and how I wanted to do this. And then I also had another story that I always wanted to tell, which was the story of my father. So my father, as I mentioned earlier, didn't graduate high school. And he was considered not smart. But that was before they realized with ADD, with Adderall and extra time, you could go to Harvard. Turns out he was dyslexic. So he went into the Navy and then he went to occupational school or whatever school it was. He learned how to be a mechanic. And he literally was fixing business machines and he started his own company. And like I said, he met my mom. They lived unhappily ever after. We moved to New Jersey. And the same thing, my mom sort of went through the same thing that I was going through, I guess, when she turned into her midlife crisis. And she was exploring what she wanted to do to find herself. And she dragged my father to an art class. And he was sitting there bored, and the teacher felt sorry for him. And he gave him a piece of clay. And my dad started playing with the clay. And at the end of the class, he had produced a perfect bust of my mother. It was like the spitting image of her. The teacher was so impressed. And it started this lifelong passion that my father just became enthralled with. He studied with artists. He went to Italy and went to the quarries to get stone. He won awards. He was featured on the cover of the New York Times with one of his statues. And it was really incredible. He became so cultured and so interested in everything from someone that had absolutely nothing.
Wait a minute. Let me just ask you. So he was using clay and then you said something about stone. So how do you mold stone? Are you talking about carving?
Yeah, he started with clay. It was what he started with. And he worked in terracotta. And then he started working in stone also. He would carve, chisel the stone. He created a studio in our backyard. And he would go back. It was good and bad. Because I guess it maybe saved their marriage because he would literally wake up and go back into his studio. And for many years, I was his model. So there's a lot of stone statues of me. I have my childhood, like, posing for him and him taking pictures of me. Yeah. And he was super uber talented. And it was just like, if he hadn't been dragged into that class, he would have never found that. And I do the parallel with me is that, you know, had I not taken that one comedy class and discovered this passion, I would have never found it. And so the punchline to my story was, it's never too late to find your marvelous. And the name of my show was The Miserable Mrs. Madison.
But wait a minute, you weren't really miserable, were you? I mean, in other words, you were miserable because family wasn't what you thought it would be, or it was, you were just over it?
You know, I think parenting is, it's very hard, and being a full-time parent is very hard. I don't know anyone. Like, I always talk about having it all. It's such a bunch of crap. Because, like, my friends that work feel like they're missing out on a lot. And my friends that stay home, it's hard being a parent. You have, like, no identity of your own. And there's no, you know, like, I joke in comedy, like, it's okay if you ignore me and laugh at me because that's what I'm used to at home. You know, my kids are either ignoring me or laughing at me, you know, or cursing me out. They don't get that on stage, thank God. But yeah, it was, I just felt I felt like I was capable of doing, I mean, I love my kids I said my youngest daughter is the gift that keeps on giving me comedy. I mean, literally I could do like 5 hours on her. And their accomplishments are giving me the greatest joy in everything. They're my life. But there was something inside of me that always wanted to do more. Like I said, if I had a penny for every idea I had, I'd be like a billionaire right now. Yeah. I craved to do something that was I was a creative soul. Like when I was in high school, I was a dancer and I did a little acting and I was stifled a little bit. I knew there was something more.
What was the biology thing? I mean, what did you want to do with a biology degree? Were you really smart in biology, that kind of thing?
Well, you know, I had two older brothers. And like I said, my parents wanted them to be doctors and lawyers. That was all that they could be. And that's all I heard in my house. And I heard a lot of fighting and a lot of yelling over grades and a lot of, you know, my dad had a temper. And I would look at it and be like, ooh, I'm not going to be yelled at like that. So I was a good little girl. You know, I did my work. I studied hard and I did what they wanted. I went to school to be a doctor. And I was smart and I was, you know, biology, science driven. I wanted to be not only a doctor, I wanted to be a heart surgeon. I rode an ambulance when I was in high school and I volunteered in the operating room when I was in college. And literally, I didn't go to med school because I almost failed physics.
Okay, wait a minute, back up. They take volunteers in operating rooms.
Yeah. I would sit in the, it was like, I remember a window, they were doing like open heart surgery and I was sitting there watching it outside of the hospital, like in their little observing area. It wasn't like doing anything, but.
Why'd they let you do that?
Because I was pre-med.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. So you graduated just straight 4 years, got a bachelor's.
Yeah. And the funny story about physics is I couldn't get it. I'm not a word problem person. It's like, you know, the train leaves the station. It's like, let it go. I couldn't do it. And I had this physics tutor come and he said to me, he was getting so frustrated. He finally turns to me and he says, okay, suppose you're at a frat party, right? And someone throws a beer can out the window. And I'm like, okay, you really have very low standards for me. That was his impression of my life.
That's so funny. Yeah. But listen, it sounds like you got your father's creativity.
Yeah, we all sort of got their creativity, but what I took away from it, and the moral I try to tell my kids all the time, and for anyone that's like searching for what they want to do, you got to try. You know, if my dad didn't walk into that class, or if I didn't take my class, we might not have ever discovered our passions.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't that something, especially when you meet somebody and they're only in their 20s or whatever, and you just want to say like, you have the whole world in front of you, you know, do anything you want. But I think sometimes, I mean, at least for me, I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. A lot of times people get married early. If they think if they're not married by 25 or 27, then there's a problem. And so not everybody, but a lot of people get married and then they settle down. And when I say settle down, I mean, they get a pretty nice house. And in Pittsburgh, it's right. Not that expensive to live. So once you start getting creature comforts, you know, it's hard to step away from that. I think that's why kids out of college, you know, it's a good time to like go do something. Go do something, you know, because otherwise you don't want to settle too fast. I always think delayed gratification is a good thing. You know, just hold on like to your guns or your own credibility, you know, just hold on to it. Say, no, I am a comedian. If I'm not funny now, I'll be tomorrow or whatever. If that's what you want, then you go for it. And then you do get better the more you do it, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, but there's also the conundrum of like, do what you love and the money will follow, which is, I don't think necessarily true.
Right. I know, but you do, there's so many things to do in the meantime. I mean, in other words, you know, there are all of the waitressing jobs and, you know, waitressing do you think, by the way, that most waitresses in comedy clubs do want to be comedians? Cause I haven't found that true.
No. I found a lot of them are pursuing other things and it's just their way of making money.
Sure. Because it's just serving drinks and the bar tabs are high.
Yeah. It's just like an extra way of making money.
Yeah.
But I do have the theory of like, you know, my parents wanted us to be doctors and lawyers. So, you know, we revolted and we were creative. And so we're all creative and we don't make money. So now I'm raising my kid. We're all unsatisfied in our careers because our parents made us do that.
Yeah.
And we want our kids to be creative. So they're going to be creative and then they're going to be poor and they're going to raise their kids to be doctors and lawyers. it kind of flips generations. You know, you always want what you can't have.
Yeah.
But they're going to be like, why'd you encourage this? I'm miserable.
That's so funny.
But I do. I encourage my kids to do whatever they want. Yeah. And I encourage them to go out and follow their dreams and just explore and try. Like my little one, who's so like me, she will never, ever try stand up or anything comedy related because it's what I do.
Yeah.
But she'd be really good at it, you know, and she just won't.
Well, now part of what you do now is business. I mean, you're definitely, you know, you're basically running a business. And when you produce shows, you know, it's all about organizing and all that. So, you know, you're not just a creative person. You obviously have business skills. Yes.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because I joke around a lot after I produce a show and I perform in it, I'll get off stage. And after the show, everyone will run up to me and they'll be like, congratulating in the comments. They'll be like, oh my God, Felicia, you're so good at producing shows. And I'm like, you know, I did just come off stage. Nothing about the comedy, right?
That is so funny. I get that too. You put together a really good lineup, Christine. Really good lineup. And I'm like, okay, was I funny? I mean, let's face it. A lot of the reasons why I produce shows is to get the stage time. And,
correct.
You know, even to have my own podcast is because I want to say something and I can't wait for somebody to ask me because what if they don't?
Right. Well, I over the years have, you know, managed 3 kids, a husband and all their events and all their activities and their bar mitzvahs, their parties, their book fairs, their school fairs, whatever. So I have a lot of organizational skills and I know how to multitask. And I mean, it was a little bit of a low bar going into the club scene because I remember I came with a typed list and they were super impressed.
Wait a minute. You had a typed set list?
No, I had a typed list of like who was performing and their times.
Oh, I see.
And they were like, wow, thank you. I'm like, yeah, it's called a computer and a printer. It's not a problem.
You're so mature. Yeah. I love it. That's really funny. Do you remember any of your very first jokes when you first got on stage that like really nailed it and they still work? Do you have any of those?
Yeah, a lot. Well, you know, I go back to a lot of them. I do remember after my first set, everyone came up to me afterwards and they were all amazed that I didn't make any jokes about my husband. They're like, I can't believe your husband got off so scot-free. And I'm like, you know, he's a great guy. I would say there's not really that much to make fun of. And then they all were like, oh my God, do I have material for you?
Yeah.
Wow. People started offering me like, but yeah, I mean, I think I use a lot of it. I mean, I use a lot of my kids' jokes. You know, like my daughter, my youngest one, I'm like, she looks like me, she acts like me, and I can't stand her. is in my routine.
That's funny.
And a lot of my marriage jokes are, you know, one of the jokes I tell about my husband is, you know, he would never leave me because he couldn't bear to part with half his money. but I don't do that one a lot. I do a lot of jokes about parenting and I go back to a lot. Like my mom always gives me really good advice with my kids and my husband and everything. And I always walk away from my conversations with her and think to myself, where the hell was she when I was growing up?
Oh, yeah. See, that's the thing. Adults, I swear to God, my mom's the same way. She's like, oh, honey, we've always had a lot of food in the refrigerator. You know, we always did this or always did that. And I'm like, no. That's not how it went down.
I mean, she tells me stuff like, you're so hard on them. Don't stress them out. Let them relax. It's not a big deal. And I'm like, you were yelling at my brothers like every day to like study harder, get better grades, go to a good college. I mean, what did you do with my mom?
Because old people mellow out. They just do. They mellow out. Let me ask you, did your dad, once he found his passion in carving and sculpture, did he mellow out?
You know, he was older and we were out of the house. Like I know my mom always tells me that her favorite part of her life was when she was in her 50s. And I said to her, but we were gone. And she's like, exactly.
That's
but
funny.
He Touché. Did mellow out. Yeah. It was, you know, my dad was, you know, the sad part of the one woman show, which is why people really liked it. And I really enjoyed it the part that I didn't tell in this story was I was ashamed of him because he was like a grease monkey and he sent me to a private school and he would drop me off in his gross truck and he'd have tattoos and I never really appreciated all that he did and sacrificed for me until he was on his deathbed. And I realize now in retrospect how, you know, he just didn't have the opportunities and he did the best that he could. His father died when he was six. Oh. And so he had to provide for his family. So for him, providing and loving was giving them money. He did the best that he could. Yeah. But he became from someone who had nothing, like a Renaissance man. I woke up in high school to grunts and groans of my dad. He taught himself how to do yoga. He would be on his head doing headstands in his tidy whities. And he bicycled and he did everything except cook.
But that's really great. That's great that he had that epiphany and was able to, you know, really, that's the thing, you know, and especially when it comes to like yoga or hobbies, the things that we do when we, you know, how we spend our time is age doesn't have that much to do with it. I mean, you could sculpt forever, you know? So that's nice that he found an art like that.
Yeah. What was interesting. And the other part of the story is that he ended up with Parkinson's disease. And the first signs of it, which we didn't even realize were the first signs of it, were his sculptures were starting to not be as good.
Really?
Yeah. He did like that's my sad. Kids. Yeah. He did my kids and it was like, looked nothing like them. And we all were like, that's weird. It was the first thing to go, his eye-hand coordination.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess Parkinson's, because that's the electrons or something, right? And that's what makes them shake, right?
Yeah.
Something's misfiring or something.
Yeah, so it was a very sad story, but a very enlightening one, because like in the end, he showed me and taught me to never stop looking for your dreams.
I love it. I love it so
much. Never too late. Never too late.
And let me tell you something. Your kids, as smart asses as they may be, they are respecting what you're doing. I guarantee it.
My two older ones do.
Their mother is a comedy booker in New York City. It's cool.
Yeah, they do. It's funny. A lot of, also, you know, we were debating before the show started if we found her calling late in life. And we decided to go with it. But it's funny because a lot of people say to me when I say, oh, I'm too old, it's not going to happen. They're like, Phyllis Diller started when she was 40. And I'm like, well, that would make me feel better if I were 40.
No, but you see the point, obviously. And again, Rodney Dangerfield, he didn't get going till his 50s. And frankly, comedians, you know, being funny, this isn't about athleticism. You know what I mean?
Right.
What the fuck, man? You could tell jokes in your 80s. I mean, what exactly is holding back a comedian's sense of humor? Nothing.
Nothing. Their fear. Only their fear.
Yeah, but this is really good. Your kids get to see this and they see you. And I'll bet you, especially the little one, the youngest daughter, I'll bet you she ends up doing something creative and she will really look to her mom and be like, oh, man, that was cool.
I hope so. From your mouth to her ears.
I hope so, too. I hear you, though. I hear you. Being a parent is a whole thing, isn't it? I mean, I'm really glad I have one child, but I'm glad I hit it and I quit it. But boy, I'm also very glad I didn't have her till my 40s. I wasn't ready. So
yeah, you're probably much mellower. Everyone always says like about her, like, how does she feel about it? And I said, you know, she's a teenager, so whatever I do is an embarrassment. So this is just like extra embarrassment.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't win. You really can't.
And I guess she took the brunt of it because she was still home. Like, she doesn't even, this is what kills me. I didn't start till she was like 14, 15, and she was very independent and she really wanted nothing to do with me. And she doesn't even remember me being home and taking care of her.
Oh, that little brat.
Right?
She thinks you've been gone every Friday and Saturday for her old child.
Yeah, she doesn't remember the first 13 years of her life that I was home, like, wiping her ass and, like, taking her to classes and, you know, throwing her parties, her birthday parties, and making her, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Well, you know, you did the right thing because, you know, now she's grown up and it's over, you know. So I think about my child when she was 2 and 3 and 4, and I was a stay-at-home mom, and I'm so happy I was because it's so far gone. It's just crazy how...
Yeah, it goes fast.
The little ones. Yeah, especially the little ones. It's such a short period of time that they're that cute.
Yeah. It's and you're always like wishing it away. You're always like, I wish she could do that. I wish she could do this. I wish, you know, it's just like, just enjoy. That's what I say to my friends with younger kids. Just enjoy it. Don't, you know, you enjoy the
moment.
Clean
the house once a day and wait till they're in bed.
Yeah.
Hey, well, do you know Molly Heckerling?
No, the name sounds familiar.
She's a comedian. She lives there in New York. I just saw her when I was there in May. But she's a comic. I'm gonna shoot her over to you because I don't know if she knows the West Side comedy. I'm not sure. She's on the Upper West Side, but
that's where we are.
Oh wow! I'm gonna connect you guys. Two cool people.
Okay.
I'm gonna do that.
Yeah, the name sounds familiar. Someone else told me about her recently, and I was surprised I didn't know her.
Her dad was Harold Ramis.
Oh,
and her mom was Amy Heckerling, who wrote and directed Clueless and Fast Times at Ridgemont High and all that stuff.
Oh, really?
Director.
Now that would impress my daughter.
Yeah, right? No kidding.
Now we're talking.
Hey, this has been so much fun. And I'm really glad we finally got to really sit down and chat for a minute, Felicia. Thank you so much.
Yeah, same. I'm glad this worked out. And when you're in New York, definitely give me a buzz.
Oh. I'm all over that for sure. All right, you guys, head over to Twitter and find Felicia Madison, Felicia L. Madison, and tell her you liked her story. Would you do that? And then you follow me over there as well at Storyworthy. Okay? That's easy, right? Yes. 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 All right. And then head over to storyworthypodcast.com and join my mailing list. Would you do that? Yes. Thank you. I appreciate it. All right, you guys, one more time on behalf of the very talented Felicia Madison, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is fun. My name is Christine Blackburn saying, make it a story worthy week.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.